You were born poor, desperately poor, Francesco. Your father took you away with the whole family from a Sicily scarred by hunger. He dreamt of America, but he stopped at Genoa. What remains for you of lingua glossa on the slopes of Mount Etna, except the myth of a homeland, the nostalgia for something you never knew except in the words of your parents? All your art was an art of nostalgia, a desire to return to the poised forms of an ideal classicism. Greece. But you still couldn't know about this when you lived a few steps from the house of Paganini and wandered the narrow back streets of Genoa, hungry, trying to make ends meet. You started working when you were just a boy. Hard work, with craftsmen amidst marble and labourers even more statuesque than the stones themselves. You studied in the evening, at the Confederazione Operaia, looking for a way to harness your volcanic talent. Just past childhood, not yet a young man, you are already sculpting stone for the cemetery of Staglieno, Genoa's open-air museum, and you watched Marinetti and Futurism with adolescent enthusiasm. One of the few such instances in your life, basically always distant from any trends or currents. You always knew you were an artist. In Genoa, people noticed it when you were just 16, in an exhibition of works at the Società Promotrice delle Belle Arti that you later destroyed because they no longer met your standards. You raced through your life, Francesco, trying to climb back from the abyss of your ancestral poverty, to reach the top, towards the mouth of the volcano, to look down into it, afraid you wouldn't have enough time to make it or enough talent. Your story seems romantic, the narrative of a passionate 19th century life. Your story seems romantic, the narrative of a passionate 19th century life. Hard work by day, encounters in the evening, when you were just 20, with Eugenio Montale or Camillo Sbarbaro, the nighttime for studying, when you weren't fighting with your father, frustrated by a life that had wounded his pride. In Genoa, Montale taught you about music, and it was thus, worthy of a phaeton, that you met Bianca at the Politeama, the most beautiful woman in the world in your eyes. Still young, though you were much younger, married to an older man. Your worship of her echoed with Dolce Stil Novo. Throughout your life she was an emblem of beauty, to reach, to conquer. Your love was both sudden and patient. It lasted a lifetime. You met Milan for the first time on the way to Venice, to the tables of the Florian on Piazza San Marco, where the Novecento group gathered during the days of the Biennale. You listened, quietly, hungry for life, as they discussed things. The cavernous voice of Carrà asked you who you were, what you were doing there. 2 years later, at the age of 21, always ready to forge ahead, you too showed work, together with them, at the Biennale Gardens. Do you remember when that austere-looking man approached you and asked you who had made the bronze of the dead Christ? "It's mine," you replied. He kept his counsel. Then, whispering in your ear, he simply said, "You've done it," and vanished. He was Adolfo Wildt. It was as if the Milan of art had officially adopted you. You began to spend time in that city, Brera, the galleries, the art foundries, and Arturo Martini, at the Prima Mostra del Novecento Italiano in the Palazzo della Permanente, where you showed a self-portrait. He was older than you, and for many artists of your age, he was already a mentor. Just as in a serial novel, Martini was a friend for excursions, the unbridled genius, ready to wake you up in the middle of the night to show you a just-completed work. He was courtly with Bianca, affectionate to the point of tears with your mother. Carrà advised you to study the tradition, while Martini, restless, started to lose faith in statues. You followed Carrà's advice and found yourself occupying, a few years later in 1932, the lecturer's post at Brera that once belonged to Wildt. Martini never forgave you for that. You were outside the regime, not as much of an opportunist as many of your colleagues in those years. You hastily joined the party to keep that teaching job. You were just happy to have some economic wherewithal, some social prestige. Your opinion of the Duce was what everyone taught and no one said. Except for Medardo Rosso, a Torinese in Milan, a Milanese in Paris, already venerable, who was honored with an exhibition organized by Margherita Sarfatti at the gallery Bottega della Poesia. Mussolini himself presided over the opening. Do you remember, Francesco, when Rosso nonchalantly put his arm around the Duce's shoulder? Di un pu, Benito, the sculptor asked dryly. Te sonet sempre il violin? Te fe ben, la più importante della politica. Tell me, Benito, do you still play the violin? Good for you, it is more important than politics. These are recollections you have imprinted in your book of memoirs, Francesco, because you always liked writing, especially poetry, and spending time with writers, even better, with poets. Salvatore Quasimodo, first of all, another emigrant like you, from the land of myth, hermetic Sicily, employed by the Public Works Office of Sondrio. 4 hours by train from Milan to get there, 4 to return, every day. Time entirely devoted to reading and to translating the classics. And then hours stolen from slumber to meet with you at the tables of Savini, with Sinisgalli, Solmi, Gatto, Marussing, De Grada, Cantatore. They made you the director of Brera, and you made monuments to the glory of the regime. The dying dictatorship named you to the Royal Academy of Italy. Then, in the end, everything collapsed. The war set your life back to zero. You were purged, pushed away, scorned. You had lost everything except Bianca's love. You two had married during the bombings. Only a few close friends remained, Vanni Scheiviller or Vittorio Barbaru, both upstanding antifascists. Lucio Fontana, who generously let you to do his portrait for the exhibition you were organizing in Buenos Aires. He also lent you money to cast some of your bronzes. You left Italy without credit. You returned triumphant from South America, as is only fitting for a serial romance. Milan remained your city throughout your life, praised in every museum in the world, an acknowledged master of what was perhaps a figurativism out of step with the times, but honest and vital, technically impeccable. You brought to this city with you even when you showed in Philadelphia or St. Petersburg, Paris or Tokyo, Vienna or Washington, alongside Arp, Brancusi, Epstein, Giacometti, Lawrence, Moore, Picasso. Even your most famous work, The Dying Horse in front of the Rai headquarters in Rome, brings something of this city with it. The Wild Horses of the Argentine Pampas, seen 10 years earlier, had remained in memory. You imagined a stallion mortally wounded in a battle of love. You couldn't sleep at night. In your studio in Brera, there was no way to work on the armature. You moved to an enormous space inside Fonderia Battaglia, behind the Cimitero Monumentale. You worked in the cold, damp space with tons of wet clay on scaffolding. Maybe you felt, really and truly, like a classic artist, a Leonardo designing his equestrian monument, a Donatello, a Mocchi, never Michelangelo, whom you studied with infinite devotion. Whenever possible, you went to the new museum in the castle, done by BBPR, where Michelangelo's last work was on display, the Pietà Rondanini, purchased with funds raised by the citizens of Milan. Since your youth, you spent time in cemeteries and made funerary monuments. You always knew that death had to be considered while still alive. You wanted a studio that was also your mausoleum. You wanted it while still alive. You found the ruins of the church of San Sisto, far from Via Cesariano, from the area of the Arena Civica where you lived. It was at Carrobbio, the Roman Quadrivium, a place of passing trucks and markets on the way to Porta Ticinese. The war had destroyed the area, and the economic boom was rebuilding it anew, forgetful of its past, ready to jettison its urban legacy. But San Sisto had even been founded by the Longobards, and in the distant past it had been a Benedictine monastery shut down by San Carlo for the dissoluteness of the monks. His cousin Federico, the one in the Promessi Sposi, had it rebuilt. Riccini designed the facade. Then it was deconsecrated, transformed into a military warehouse, bombed. Art that is born, dies, rises again in a series of plot twists of history as in a novel. Your natural objective correlate. You donated 100 of your works to the municipality and transformed the church into your own museum while you are still alive. You had reached the top of the volcano. You could look down into the crater without fear and think back on your life. To recall, perhaps, that day almost 50 years earlier, in one of the saddest years of your existence, at the bedside of Arturo Martini, rushed to the Fate Bene Fratelli Hospital, dying. You were there with Marino Marini and Giacomo Manzù, the four M's of Italian sculpture, people said back then. The charm of names in Milan is strange. There were also Luciano Minguzzi and Fausto Melotti. It would be like a fairy tale for children, where all those letters M in a circle looked like a crown around the artist who had recently announced the death of sculpture itself. But you did not believe in the death of your very life. You knew that in another hospital in Milan, at Cagranda, your group of statues of San Carlo granting pardon to the hospitaller deputies established a silent dialogue with the group sculptured by your mentor. Francesco Sforza and Bianca Maria Visconti offer Pope Pius II the design of the Cagranda. Works done in parallel, barely 10 years earlier, when everything was still happening. And they are still there, those sculptured stones, to the left and right of the entrance portico. Beyond yourselves, beyond your tumultuous lives, as an admonition and a memory for all the people of Milan.